just finished my shiurim last week, last Wednesday, Thursday, Yerubchina. And so, I mean, I'm not sure that I'll be able, I mean, to perform the way I'm used to. What I'm trying to do tonight is simply to analyze a few rashis in the Parshat Aseret Adibrei. As a matter of fact, I worked out all the rashis in Parshat Aseret Adibrei, but I believe it will stand evening on three or four short sentences of rashis. It's very important for us now, I mean for us, Rabbanim as well as people in the educational field, and even Talmidei Chachamim who are in the professions, to delve in Dibrei Chazal, in sayings of our sages and rabbis, to understand them well. I mean, we are very careful with Aloche, being very negligent as far as our God is concerned. Now in Ira, which tremendous problems arise, society is in state of flux. Many verities are being questioned. Many foundations are undermined. There's exploration, questing for objectives unknown to the people who do the questing. And the rabbi's task today is compounded, very complex. And it's important that he should be able to, not homiletically, but logically, philosophically, to take modern events and place them in our old biblical Talmudic Agadic frames of reference. I'm trying to do it tonight. I mean, the ideas I'll express are well known to all of us, but whatever the frame of reference is new. The first pasuk of the Aseret Adibrei begins, וידבר אלוקים את הדבורים הואילה לאמור. לפי עבד רשא, רשא סב, אין אלוקים אלא דיון. As a matter of fact, the four words plus the fifth word, אין אלוקים אלא דיון לי פוריה, are quoted from the Mechilta. The rest is Rasha, I mean, consists of Rasha's comments to the Mechilta. Ein Elokim Ela Dayan Liporeha. Unquote, Mechilta. Now Rasha adds his own. Lefi sheyesh parshiyos shebatoro. Shimosam odom mekabel schar. Vim lav ein mekabel aleihem puronyos. Yochel, some echo, I mean, couldn't be in this, as a sound, there is a... Yochel, the dance better. Yochel, at a seres a divris kach, Talmud Lema, put up the mic. כך תלמוד לימר וידבר אלוקים דיון ליפוריה. Very hard to guess. In my opinion, Rashi's text was identical with our text. Rashi added simply commentary. Perhaps Rashi had a different text of the Sifri. And it's a straight quote from the Sifri. So let me just, for the sake of those who don't belong to the Rabbinical Council of America, I'll translate us. The word Elikim is the term for a judge. Since there are chapters in the Torah of such a character, that if a person observes the commands contained therein, you will receive a reward. And if you never observe them at all, you will not receive punishment on their account. One might think that the Ten Commandments are also of such a character that no punishment will follow upon the infringement of them. Therefore, the scripture expressly states, God spoke, God who is judge exacting punishment spoke. Do you understand the meaning? I don't. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to explain the Rashi. I want to just explain the Michut, Ein Elokim Dayan Liparea. But since we read the Rashi, Rashi most probably, as all the portion of Rashi assume, refers to, Rashi speaks about chapters, which, if one does not observe them, he is not punished. However, if he does comply with them, he receives a reward. And I could be misled into thinking that brother said that Aseret HaDibrei, this chapter belongs to that class, that the non-observant, one does not incur punishment by non-observant, but receives reward by observance. Therefore, that's why by that Rekim, Rekim spoke, Rekim means a judge exacting punishment. What chapter is Rashi speaking about? It's a mystery, it's a enigma. What chapter? Most probably, the commandments and the chapters referred by Rashi to are those which are to be observed only when the conditions specified are present. For instance, if one wears a garment four corners, he must provide the garment with stitches. However, if he doesn't wear the garment at four corners, he is not supposed, he is not commanded to provide the garment with stitches. Yes, however, if he does put on a garment four corners and provide them with stitches, he receives reward. But the absence of the garment, by not wearing the garment, he does not incur punishment. Or for instance, the Chisar Makeh, it's in the Bible for the Chisar Makeh right here. If I build a house, and the house is a flat roof on which people walk, or people take spend time, I have to build a railing around in order to prevent people from falling. However, if the roof, if I have no house, or the roof is slanted, not flat, no people, walk on the roof, so there is no mitzvah mark. If I build a house with a flat roof and I make a market, I'm rewarded. But non-building, abstaining from building a house with a flat roof does not incur any punishment. Also, a mezuzah. If I live in a house and there is a door frame, I have to attach a mezuzah, to nail down a mezuzah to the door frame. If there is no door frame, there's no mitzvah mezuzah. However, if I make a door frame, I fulfill a mitzvah, and of course, and I receive a reward. So what does Rashi say? I might assume that Aseret HaDibrei belongs to that class of chapter. Rashi is speaking most probably, as all the forces say, of the so-called mitzvah of shoes. To use the term by the Rambam, the Maimonides term, mitzvah of shoes. It means the mitzvah is binding only in a certain situation, under certain definitive circumstances. There is no duty upon me to involve myself in those circumstances in order to incur the imperative or the duty. However, if I do place myself in such a situation and I comply with the mitzvah, so the reward is assured. Where does Rashi, first of all, most commandments in that sense are negative. Latest. You cannot apply the whole idea to a latest. The Sirtsa, Signet, Sinot, the Son of Racha, the Shoker, the Zachmik. What would I expect when they were? I would not work. I'm not punished for it. If I don't, if I don't kill myself, I'm not punished. But I don't receive a reward either for not killing. We have only three mitzvahs, three positive precepts. in the Aseret HaDibrei. Or Mechi, Shabbos and Shabbos. Look what the Rashi says. Shabbos what? I'm not punished what? If I infringe upon the Mitzvah Shabbos? Or Kavod Aveim, if I don't observe Kavod Aveim? What, if I don't have a father and a mother on me? You can store it. If one is an orphan, he cannot fulfill the Mitzvah. We don't understand what Rashi means. First of all, 7 hours of ten are lovey. What? The whole problem of Mitzvah Shusset is inapplicable to lovey. Three are absolute Mitzvahs. They bind the person without having him getting involved, become involved in a certain situation. You don't understand. As a matter of fact, I was not going to explain the Rashi to you. I suspect that Rashi is talking about something else. As a matter of fact, I haven't written it out. Rashi apparently thinks, since the service had degraded, or according to Rashi Goyen to Rashi, Rabbi Nachman ben Rambam, the most Rishonim concur with him, so to say, the principle or the roots of the system of Tayag Mitzvah, the Sateiro of the Mitzvah. So each love in the Aseret HaDibrei somehow has a corresponding aspect which requires of a person just opposite action, from action which is the reverse from that which has been prohibited by the law. For instance, the law of the Sirtach. I mean, corresponds to certain assays, or rather has certain assays, corresponds, which require of men to support and to help and to promote and to save and to protect life. And you need to do our living. The same is true of the signate. And the same is true of the Sanhedrin Achrei Choker. On the contrary, you should tell the truth, Tzedek Tzedek. As far as the truth is concerned, the Sanhedrin Al Damrei Achrei, and so forth, Kibitul HaNefo, the Sisum Makel HaGagecho, and so forth, and each Lysasse in the Aseret HaDibrei is linked up with an Asay in other chapters, which requires that man he should engage in action which is the reverse, positive action which is the reverse of the simple action which has been prohibited by the Aseret HaDibrei. And all those essays are binding. And if I don't fulfill the mitzvah essay, I'll be punished. This is the only way in which I can interpret Rashi. All right, but this is not my job today, tonight. What I want to interpret is the five words of the Mechuteh, which Rashi wrote. If you have a Mechuteh, you can see that the Mechuteh does not have the rest. The Mechuteh has Ein, Elokim, Elodayim, Liporeya, correct? The number of others. The name Elohim is indicative, according to the Mechuteh, of judgment and a judge exacting punishment. In other words, so what does the Mechuteh mean? Mechuteh Rashi. Well, what does the Mechuteh mean? Exacting punishment. Of course, there is punishment for every violation, for every transgression, and for every fulfillment and implementation of a mitzvah. There is reward. In other words, the sinner is punished wherever the king appears in a parsha, or whenever the king decrees a law, prohibits certain action, recommends some action, violation of any mitzvah decreed by Elohim is punished during the lifetime of the sinner. Boilam Azeh, this one. Retribution is not delayed until man faces his maker in the world. Like the case is in other mitzvahs, with regard to other mitzvahs. Ayin la feisom, today to prachis, moho, left the world, the top of the world, the system of. those mitzvahs which are associated with name Elohim, any violation of them incurs punishment immediately. Right here and now. That's all that the Nesil can say. Because the rest consists of Rashi's additional comments. Let us analyze this matter. Elohim is characteristic of the idea of retribution and reward which comes swiftly during our lifetime. Why? How did we think about it? Chazal has dwelt many times upon the distinction between the Shem Abayah, the Shem Ben Abayah, that's the Ramadan, and the Mikis. The Ramban quotes the Midrash in Breishis that with the arrival of man upon earth, the name of God, which appears in the first chapter of Genesis as Elohim, was expanded into Hashem Elohim. The creation of man warranted the addition of Havaye to Elohim. The Ramban expresses himself succinctly by saying, Shem Molei al Elam Molei. The complete name began to prevail in a world which had been completed. Of course, completed with the creation of man. In other words, as long as man was absent from the world, God acted through the Midas Elohim, as Elohim. The very instant creation was completed by the emergence of man, God has begun to reveal himself not only as Elohim, but as Havaye Elohim. Creation became complete, so has the divine name. In other words, God's relationship to creation is a dual one. As Elohim and as Havaye. Apparently, Midut, nature, both inorganic and organic, is ruled by the Shem Elohim. While nature plus man who is endowed with logos and speech is confronted not only by Elohim but by Havaye as well. What is the distinction between the encounter with Elohim and the encounter of man or confrontation of man with a vice? Elohim denotes a relationship of might and power. For Aleph Lamed Keil, or even Elohim in Hebrew, we come across that the term quite often in Tanakh, as the connotation either of might, stupendous might, or of socio-political power, like being a judge or a ruler. Rashi himself said, "Yema feitz adishem alekim eret b'shomoyim, adishem alekim, adishem hushmei, Havaye is the genuine name. Elohim, what does Elohim denote? Shalit v'shefet al keil." So Rashi expressed himself. Elohim has the connotation of shalit v'shefet, ruler and judge. Hawaii is his name, whereas Elikim signifies that he's a ruler and a judge of all. In other words, the name of Elikim symbolizes two orders. First, the cosmic order. Second, the socio-political order. Let us see. First, Elikim stands for causality. It's a general principle governing the cosmic drama. His general principle is to be found in Elikim. For cosmic, it stands for cosmic dynamics, for the boundless reservoir of physical energy, for the natural drama, for the might and grandeur of the universe. In every aspect of those of the universe, you discover the fingerprint of Elikim. Elikim, in this context, is the legislator of the natural law, or of the mathematical equation which rules all cosmic phenomena, all cosmic events. Elikim determines physical events. Elikim reveals himself through the totality of the causal nexus and through the individual events per se. And what is, and this is very strange, people don't understand, and what is the natural law about which physics speaks, about which chemistry or biology, if not the expression of God's primordial will, which has been embedded in organic and inorganic matter? What is the fall of the stone, or the roar of the sea, the flight of the bird, the circular motion of the insect around an electric ball, the quiet still summer night, the movement of my finger, my urge for food, if not the manifestation of God's penetration into the depths of nature? Now, let us just speak about certain phenomenon which, I mean, prima facie appears to you to be very humorous or perhaps funny. But within the context of murder or society, it's not funny at all. On the contrary, it is tragic. Violation of the natural law. One can violate not only the moral law or the religious law. One, human beings are capable of violating the natural law. Violation of the natural law results always in catastrophe. Rebellion against the rule of Elikim, expressing itself through the causal link to the dynamics of organic and inorganic matter, and necessarily, inevitably, in disaster. The science, for instance, of the law of, and please don't laugh at me, the science of the law of gravitation by leaping from the 10th floor to the sidewalk will destroy, inevitably, a human life instantly. Didn't take long. And a diabetic neglecting to observe a sugar-free diet will shorten his life and bring about death, if not instantaneously, at least gradually. An alcoholic will finally develop some disease, like cirrhosis of the liver, and end his life tragically. And so God does not tolerate violator and transgressor of the natural law which he has established for the cosmos and man alike. And when I'm speaking about violators of the natural law, I want you to understand, don't look at me in amazement and good humorly. I am not discussing now maniacs or psychopaths with suicidal tendencies who defy the natural law. The Vayemer Elohim Yehi. In our biblical lingo, the natural law means Vayemer Elohim Yehi. I am referring to historical eras, to cultural climates, to hedonic-minded societies, which are driven almost compulsively to rebel against our king, as expressed through the natural law. What is cultural decadence? People speak many times about cultural decadence. They speak about the cultural decadence of late Rome in antiquity. Now people begin to speak about cultural decadence of the Western world, and about the United States. What is cultural decadence? What is it characteristic of? It is, of course, characteristic of a tired, frustrated society who was overambitious, overzealous, and tried to reach the impossible, standing on the brink of disaster, and trying very hard to violate the natural law. Decadence expressed itself in a tendency, in a quest, I would say in a compulsive drive, to defy the natural order, or rather to defy the authority of the one who has decreed that natural order. People try to defy not only the moral law, but the cosmic law as well. What is the curse, for instance, if you read so much about it? And it is true. I don't know what men can do in the first way. What is the curse of pollution? Who polluted the air? Who polluted the water? Well, as you tell me, industry. Right. But what has not industry? Mother man. Technologically minded man. Men striving for power, for control, for absolute, complete control over the environment. Man who simply defy the natural law. What is the evil contained in synthetic additives to food, which in many cases are detrimental to human health? What is wrong with them? I mean from a theological, metaphysical standpoint. I'm not speaking about what chemistry of food. What is wrong with the drive or with the urge to take toxic or intoxicating drugs? What is psychologically, what is metaphysically, what does lie at the root of such mad urges, such anomalous drives in the man? And it's not limited now to group of some psychopaths. It's now a universal phenomenon, a universal experience. I mean, it has penetrated not only the schools of America, but unfortunately the yeshivas of America as well. No one can protect, no yeshiva, no left or right, I mean, room or a little bit up the closet. I mean, is protected or shielded from that curse. As a rabbi, people of God have got understanding not only in psychological terms, people in psychological terms can only explore the surface, not the depth, but from a theological viewpoint. This is the defiance of man, the defiance of the authority of God. I mean, it's funny. The defiance expresses itself not only in the downbringing of the moral law, but in transgressing and violating the cosmic law, the natural law. It is a rebellion against the rebellion law. Such a rebellion which tries to change the natural law, the natural cause of events and things, must be the disaster of the Father. Being Elohim, if you try to interfere with the authority of Elohim, as expressed throughout the cosmic fabric of events, the phenomena, I will die in Victoria, a very strict, severe judge who exacts punishment. In a word, the natural law is basically an existential law. Men cannot reject it without destroying themselves. He either accepts the natural law, or he should be ready to terminate his own existence. Now, this is Elohim Shalit. But Rashi has said that Elohim is not only Shalit, Elohim also is Shalit. Judge. However, as we've remarked before, we find the name Elohim related to God's activity not only as the creator, architect, and master of the universe, but also as legislator, king and ruler of human society, of mankind as such. Elohim denotes both Shalit, unrestricted, cosmic, energistic might, he created to sustain and support the universe. Without him, creation would be dominated momentarily and the world would be in shambles. As well, he denotes also social sovereignty and unlimited power at a socio-political level, as king, as almighty ruler and judge. You know very well that Elohim is an ark in Chumash, as many times as you are unique. Elohim is a tallel. Very interesting that our law has the right to is a tallel. Two prohibitions, two injunctions. One injunction against blasphemy. Elohim is man. In this sense, Elohim is man. It's to be interpreted, referring to Kodesh Baruch Hu, and the king is a Talmud and Talmud Dayan. The judge is man. The Nigash Balabai is the king. Balabai should bring him before the court, before judges. As the king judge, God is also a lawmaker, I'm going to say. The legislator. What law does he legislate? Shall he legislate or the natural law, the mathematical equation, the link between phenomena and the particle. As a Elohim judge, he legislates the moral law. If law is not about matter, not related to matter, to the behavior of matter, but to the behavior of man. Matter of fact, matter, inorganic, organic, is far more obedient than man. We read in Parshas Noach about the seven universal principles, or laws, principles of morality, which were addressed to Noah and his children. It's quite characteristic that suddenly the Torah changes the Shem Havaye into Elohim. By Vorach Elohim, as Noah says, one of before the Torah employs the Shem Havaye. But the Torah begins to speak about the Shem Mitzvah since Tavud Neneach, there is a sudden change, a sudden transformation. The Shem Havaye turns into Elohim. By Vorach Elohim, as Neach, as Banach, by Yemalem, Uruvu, Milisoret, ואחר נפיצכם יהיה בוחה לסערת בפרית השמיים. ואת אכבוסו בנפשי דומה לסחב, ואחר זינכם לנפשי סניף הנדריש, ואת פולחה לדרשנו, מיד אודום. מיידי שוחי ודריש הסנפש אודום, שיף אדם אודום באודום דומי ישוחך, כי נצל אל הלקים עושה פרה. הבאי לזאת נשת. The moral social laws, which is the foundation, which are the foundation of any civilized society, were placed at the same level as the physical cosmic law. So the king is the legislator of both, the law governing the gravitational pull, the electromagnetic field, which make the custom world function, and the law prohibiting, as well as the law prohibiting murder, which protects the viability of society. And here again, rebellion against the king as legislator of the social moral law, and in the same manner as disobedience concerning the natural law does in catastrophe. Retribution, even for the transgression of the moral law, and I wish to warn, I mean, some people in the audience who are philosophers, that I'm not speaking about the natural law in the sense of Grotius or Cicero or the medieval scholastic. I cannot explain to you the difference because it takes up too much time. But what I'm speaking about is a different concept. Retribution is swift and severe. A society which rejects arrogantly the law, for instance, thou shalt not steal or murder, falls apart at its end. The Hitler Reich is the most characteristic case in point. Best example. An individual who is over-ambitious, over-zealous, opportunistic, unconscientious as to the means he employs to promote and further his career, will be finally cut in web of difficulties and contradictions. As a matter of fact, I believe that America's self-hatred, anomalous self-hatred of today, which is so evident on the campuses and in literature and the press, and her defeatist mood is a consequence of her arrogant and conceited and self-inflated self-evaluation or self-assessment of yesteryear. Matter of fact, I don't recognize America anymore. When I came to America, America was very self-assured, certain of himself. He thought that America has accomplished everything that is good in civilization and culture. But the rest of the world is just a bunch of illiterates. We can hardly find their names on the check. If they have checks, if they have money in the bank, on there. And there is American way of life, which is sacred, and it's got to be imitated by everybody, by East and West, by North and South. That educational system is the finest. Man enjoys unlimited liberty and freedom, and so forth and so on. Finally, America was identified and equated with the Golden Age, with the old paradise, which was lost to man. And of men's negligence, then this lost paradise was found in the United States. A lot of it was true. A lot was childish, infantile, naive. And a lot was due to arrogance. Arrogance in illiterate self-conceit. Now the American was done. He became meditative, introspective, suffers from self-hatred, whatever is American is bad, whatever is farm is good. He is exploring the world, I mean, for new deities and for new idols. And he's simply not sure of himself. In my opinion, if we believe in Ashgoche, in God's intervention in history, his penetration of human affairs, mood after day is the result of the mood of yesteryear. One who rejects parental authority will meet a similar treatment on the part of his children. I've experienced it. I don't mean my personal life, but I tell people. Promiscuity leads to complete disintegration of the family fabric and so forth. Elikim addresses himself to both, to nature and to man, and establishes laws for nature and man. He legislates both, concerning the behavior of matter as well as the conduct of man. And violation of those laws, precipitate apostasy and a swift retribution. That's exactly what the Nefilter meant by a nation of the Shem, the Kepra, Gaber, and the Kim, and the Maile, Dion Lipor, the Seraph of the Great, means before, why did Nefilter say, before in Israel, the Shem Abai, the Kwan, not the Shem, suddenly, he carried about to tell us the story of the Ten Commandments, of the revelation of Sinai, of the Decalogue which was bestowed upon the people, first of the people, the name is changed into the king. Apparently, those laws, those affairs that you know, ten principles, constitute the foundation of any civilized existence. are placed at the same level as the Lord governing nature. Now the king established the air, the velocity of light, the electromagnetic energy, and the king established the law, thou shalt not murder. Retribution is swift and constant for the violation of all. In short, the penalty is a natural one. The seed of destruction is inherent in the act of violation. It's not an extremist penalty, but actually catastrophe is a part, is precipitated by violation, by violating the natural law. In short, the penalty is a natural one. However, when the legislator is Abaye addresses himself to the people, Vayidaber, Vayikro, Abaye, Omeshe, Odom Kiyakes, Mikem Korm, then the commandment is addressed not to natural man, but to metaphysical man, to man who was chosen by God. Such mitzvahs still took a shape of such negative principles, precepts, Rehler, Stam, Rehler, Shatnes, and so forth, who were destined not to save a natural society from disintegration, but to raise the latter, the natural society, to a committed covenantal community. Those mitzvahs hallow and redeem the human spiritual personality. Non-compliance affects not natural man, but metaphysical man. It prevents man from achieving spiritual transcendental worth and distinction. It does not The natural moral law is violated, destroys human dignity. The metaphysical law which, graduated by a virus, destroys the human sanctity of all men. Hence, punishment is not immediate, not swift in coming. Punishment is delayed until that day on which human beings will be confronted by the Savior and will have to account for it. Damage is metaphysical, punishment is metaphysical. The world to come. Now let's speak second Russian. I'm fully in the center. The statement tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said all these words in one utterance, something that's impossible for the human being to do or to speak in this manner. God. Now, I would advise you to start here. It's again a mechuzah. First of all is an idea, a drosha b'chazal, interpretation, comments. I always ask. What actually prompted Rashi, motivated Rashi as a Mechuzah, to say that from the process by Dabar Elikim and Skoladvorim or Eil and Lemeir, you derive that all Ten Commandments were formulated and defined in one utterance simultaneously within the infinitesimal period of time. Because by Dabar Elikim and Skoladvorim or Eil and Lemeir, the call is completely superfluous. And God is spoken the following word, or the word that follows. Now, the Chazal interpret a person. I mean, we have no sense for Hebrew semantics now, but Chazal knew very well Hebrew semantics. But apparently, and always when they interpret a person, and prima facie, it appears to us as if they made a twist. We should always look into the semantics of the word. And in all cases, we finally realize that it was not Greek, but now simply power of the two semantics. The term called has a double meaning, has a twofold meaning, a twofold semantics in the book. So, who could help me out? Just this one. More for instance, let's take a verse. Kol Yishvi Eret V'Sheif Negeder Insei Nisorim Piru V'Hizkiya Sheifot Yishmo. What it means? All, in sense, all dwellers of the earth and residents of the world. In this context, all denotes what? Some total of people, objects, etc. This is simply plain arithmetic. If you have a sum total, you'll say call. Second, call is used quite often as one. Each one means all. Each one is one. It's subtotal. The whole is integrated, you understand. It's integrated. Piecemeal integrated simply by applying the method of addition, of adding that. If I should add object to object, phenomenon to phenomenon, man to man, I'll finally arrive at the sum. The sum consists of an additive process of integration. And actually, it has been integrated at many parts. Now, it's a Meleich al kol ha'ilom when we emphasize coolly. What does it mean? Entire in the sense of wholeness. Intrinsic unity and oneness in totality. Proclaim thy kingdom over the whole world. And there is the Hebrew idiom, I'll call it Elam Kule. Whole world, nothing should be left out. We have this expression of Kumesh as well. I mean, it's not only the one who had it at the Malga. I mean, limited to the Kule, because it doesn't call Hebrew. All Elam Kule is copied from an idiom of Kumesh. You call it a Kulam Gdeshim. Proclaim thy kingdom over the whole world. It as a whole, as entirety, totality, but intrinsic totality, not integrated. It's not a sum. Not the sum follows the path, but on the contrary, the whole precedes the path. The whole. It's not a sum total, but it is total in itself. And I'll give you an halachic example. Not only a question of semantics. We have a rule, Rube Kipulet. You read the rule. This rule of Rube Kipulet is not applicable to any pure mathematical quantity. We employ this rule of Rube Kipulei only in cases where in our halachic lingo jargon we say a hefte is involved. A hefte is required. I mean, but I know very well, I think that if we can say it only in our jargon, it cannot translate the term in another language, it means the term stands for nothing. If a term stands for an idea, I mean, it must be translatable into any language. What does hefte mean? A configurative whole. An entity which is intrinsically one. I'll give you an example. You can under no circumstances avail yourself of the principle of Rube Kipulei in a situation when a pure mathematical magnitude is to be dealt with. It would be absurd, completely absurd, to say that Rav Kazayis Matze suffices. You have to eat a Kazayis Matze. Why shouldn't a Rav suffice? Rubek Ikuna. You have to, what shall I say, you have to, a mikveh requires a boy and so, you know. Why shouldn't 21 sores be sufficient in order to declare the mikveh kosher to be perfect? What's the answer? It's ridiculous to speak about Rubi Kikulei with references to a sum, to a mathematical quantity, to mathematical measurement. If the Lulet, if the Hodesh should be 3 fucking long, you cannot say that 2 is Rubi Kikulei, because 2 mathematically is not 3. There's no equation of 2 equal 3. It's nonsensical. When we apply the principle of Rube Kipulei, for instance, Shchita, correct? Yes. Question whether it is the principle, but alright, let's say I'll go along. It's Rube Kipulei. Rube Kipulei does not mathematical quantity involved. The simonim One of the Hefts is an entity. The Beisha can be considered as an entity. In a holistic sense. As a configuration, as a whole, must be cut through. So the incision of war is suffice. They say, Rubei shall double, shall have the Tepule. But you never say in our lingo that Rubei shall shio Tepule. The monument of a shio, the two entities, have to be cut through on it. So you say, Rubei Tepule. Come, here it is. The Hefte, the entity, has been subjected to Shchita. For whenever there is Shiur is a mathematical quantity, a mathematical number. You cannot say 9 is like 10. It could be a lot. First of all, Mikvein Kule has nothing to do with Rubik Kule. Because for Rubik Kule, you would need Rav. You would need at least six and a half hours. But even Mixas Ayim Kule, you had in certain cases that the thought, Kivan Shoba Rav Ayim Bikdushe, because Yem is also an entity. Yem is completely not a sum total, because you have short and you have long. Yem is not measured and determined by the number of hours, but it's a separate entity. It's a whole. In a holistic sense, I mean, in the sense of Gestalt, there's another problem. For instance, where do you apply Mixa Yem Kikula, excuse me, Rubi Kikula, where else? Shkita, where else? Of course, let us say. Of course, I don't have a different person, okay? I'm not responsible now for time. But I have to defend him, I can defend him, but not tonight. Not tonight. And I have a good chance. So far. So it's a course. Albert Matthew, you don't apply Rubei Tekule. But as far as our case is concerned, it's the Sheis Rubei Tekule Shokot. That's the problem. Who the Shot said Rubei Tekule Shokot. Why do you apply the principle of Rubei Tekule to Kot? You don't apply it to Kazai's matter? Huh? Because, you see, the mitzvah of the Rambam has never said, and the Mishnah has never said, Val Yifchus Tolei Arba Ribi Shol Yayin. The Mishnah and the Rambam always said, Val Yifchus Tolei Arba Kete Shol Yayin. And the Rambam, in defining the beauty of drinking 4 cups of wine, says, V'chol echod v'echod ben Yisroel ben Anoshim ben Noshim Chayobim Lishtei Balaylo Hazeh Arba Kete Shol Yayin. Of course, there is a minimum prescribed for the pot. The pot must contain not less than Revi. The contents of the pot must not be less than Revi. But this is an element, an attribute, as to say, qualification as far as the pot is concerned. But if it's less than Revi, it's not pot. It's nothing. You reduce it to ad absurdum, you know. But once there is Revi in Shilotan, once the first, the volume of the first equals Revi, then the mitzvah expresses itself not in drinking Revi, but in drinking a cup of wine. And the first becomes in a holistic sense a configurative whole, a chesed, a unity, an entity. To which we apply the principle of Rubei Tekule. And I'll give you an example. What, for instance, if the pot contains not one Revi, but 5 Revi, or 4 Revi? So most Rishonim, there are some who disagree, but most Rishonim say he has got to drink more than the pot of 5 Revi. So what do you see from here? Well, the inference is clear, I mean. And I'm a critical. The mitzvah is not to drink Revi. Revi is a qualification, is a minimum required for course. Otherwise, it's not worthy, I mean, of the current course. However, the mitzvah refers to course as a whole. That's why
you indivisible. Like intent in the sense that theory of Gestalt. And so you apply the principle of Afrobeticulum. Well, they are going to be correct. For me, and we don't know. Basically, in the words of Rock Sanhedrin, you mean? You mean Rock Sanhedrin? It's basically without a sign, it is a local agreement that's over there. It's not a local agreement. Well, that's enough. Another time, I'll ask a question, and certainly objection, and certainly to me, but you have to introduce a sign. Well, tonight I'm not ready to meet. Okay, well, I'll see you in the morning. Okay, well, I'll see you in the morning. The Michilte and Rashi have interpreted. Apparently, by Daber Elohim is called Advorim O'Ele. That means that God spoke all those commandments. Because it's completely unnecessary to say all those commandments. It would have sufficed if there had said, by Daber Elohim, is Advorim O'Ele. Not called in the sense of some total, but an integrated sum. Of a sum which was added up. A sum which is preceded by component parts, where the individual object has supremacy over the sum, or rather priority, I would say. A person who feels that Russia interprets the double lekin as collaborem or aile in a holistic sense. And God knows, would you help me out? How I may move with the translation of this process? And God has proclaimed the whole or the entirety or the totality of those commandments. Not each or every of those commandments. If call is not interpreted in the sense of every or all of them, ALL, but the totality, the organic unity, the wholeness of the commandments, of all ten commandments, then call is not helpless at all. Call injects a new idea of the substance, of the new world, rather. In a word, the ten commandments has not been added up ex post facto. They are not an incidental sum of mutually unrelated precepts. The Decalogue constitutes rather a primordial entity whose unity and integrity are inherent in its very essence, or in the very essence of the system. In other words, there are not ten commandments. There is one commandment which branches out into ten aspects. Of course, the consequence, the practical consequence, not a question of semantics anymore, the practical consequence is clear and obvious. I don't have to tell it to you, but I would like to learn it, because mother of the size is not much more. The Decalogue is indivisible. You either accept all of the commandments or none at all. To choose between the commandments and to say Dein Hangeli, Dein Le Hangeli, certain commandments I like and I shall accept them, other commandments I dislike, I shall reject them, to assent to some and to ignore the other commandment is at best absurd. All of the precepts were pronounced and promulgated in one utterance or within an indivisible, infinitesimal period of time. Of course, you know very well throughout Jewish history, attempts have been made
and attempts still are being made to split us out of the United States. To pick out those norms which have, in the opinion of dissidents, nonconformists of all epochs and generations, social moral relevance, an abundant the theological premise expressed in an Echeel of Harima Heel Hoponah. And that's exactly what the Mechuta for. You take it literally, it was pronounced in one utterance, but for what for? Akhish Bokha didn't have to display his omnipotence that he can do it. What did this simultaneous proclamation of all Asara Sadibre accomplish? What did it convey to us? What did it convey to us? The organic unity and the indivisibility of the Kalam. That is exactly what the Mechilta meant to say. The Asara Sadvorim was formulated simultaneously in one utterance. In other words, the Mechilta denies the bias of what is actually in our daily language. What does the Mechilta reject? What does the Mechilta deny? What does the Mechilta abandon? The Mechilta denies the viability of the secular social morality. Once you divide Asarat HaDibre into parts and you separate the social norms from the so-called theological norms, or ritual norms, or from the premise, mainly from the premise on Ether Hashem Lashemel, from the Yira, from Zohar to Meshabbat Sakach, from Sisa Hashem Lashemel Hashot, the four cornerstones of our faith, of faith in God, and the Sinner, the Son of Rabbi Shekhar, and the Sachmet, the Sanction. Either a man accepts the authority of God as the legislator of the moral norms, be it individual or social, or gives up his attempt to mold a moral conscience and to organize a society upon the foundation of a man-made relativistic morality. Now, I'm running. This motif, which I somehow isolated from the minor Shekulam Nemru, the Dibur Echot, one Atman, is quite popular in Rashi, in Talmudic literature. Did you quote me in other Maimorim, which convey the same message, the inseparability of the moral norm from indomitable faith in God? Or the indivisibility of the Asarat HaDvarim? No. Look at the question is whether how the Asarat HaDvarim were arranged. I don't mean on the letter interpretation. I mean straight. No. Then after that, but it's on the letter book. No, I'll tell you. Instead of trying to simply to develop homiletical themes, I would suggest that we take it a chapter. Where is the chapter? Just a moment. The first issue is Peregimul Aloche. Peregimul Aloche. Very strange to say. Hananya ben Chachinoy. Amen. Nefesh kisimeil ma'al badishem. Vitichich ba'anifet. Kepikodein me bitzumet yot. They apparently didn't understand why the ma'al or ma'al badishem. Nefesh kisimeil ba'anifet. Kepikodein me bitzumet yot. To embezzle funds, embezzle objects. And deny, I mean, theft. Ein adon kisimeil ba'anifet. Normally, Wherever there is real faith in God, there is no social immorality, there is no embezzlement, there is no denial of effects, there is no perjury. One doesn't take a false oath in order to suppress some information. Stealing, embezzling, perjury are the result of a secular attitude, of a man who wants to build his own moral world and wants to be the legislator of the moral law which he has prepared. And it is such a challenge that I think so. Tamakas Shabbat Rebuli. I believe the only time it became Rebuli is when it was stopped in various of Shabbat. Motzei Philosopha Tehet. Come on. That's the philosopher. Probably the Rebuli philosopher. Omale, so the philosopher asking the French question, is this son who is to be held in contempt and hate? Whom should society hate? Whom should society consider as a contemptible creature? Omale, the Acacia of Misha Boy, whoever denies the existence of the nature of his nature. See, it is formally hated. The philosopher didn't understand. Formally, Kabe Visavicho, Lysiotos, Lysinos, Einodom Kesha Bohem, Akitesha Bito. He was asked, most probably by an Epicurean philosopher, who is to be held in contempt? Who is deserving hate of society and deserves to be excluded from society. Rabbi Reuven answered him immediately, the atheist, the agnostic, the skeptic, who denies the existence of his maker. The philosopher did not understand. The answer, why should a non-believer be held in contempt? And hate, in faith, is a private affair of the individual. His skepticism is not harmful to society. He accepts that removal to answer only a fiend of society, an arch criminal, who inflicts harm upon others, deserves to be hated. But not an innocent agnostic or atheist. The answer to this question came swiftly and unequivocally, and was stated in unequivocal terms. The essence of faith in God will lead finally to the downplay of social morality. Corruption of man is ushered in by the Lord of faith. Life is a strain, no? Okay, well, the other minor like that. Perhaps the Rahman the Mechan, yes, all right. Okay. I want to show you. This was the thought not just expressed by one. It was the opinion which all Chachmei Chazal shared. The secular attitude is a hoax. It might function for some time, but will finally break down, and with this breakdown, society will simply go into the bottomless, will plunge into the bottomless abyss. Modern society agrees with this. Dorash Ule Rabu Apis Chedrinitis. Yiducho Abishem Komal Chehoret. ושומרו אמרי פיחו, מאמר פיחו, לא נאמר על אמרי פיחו. ושוש אמר הקדוש ברוך הוא, נכי ולאי עליו. אמרו הוא מצרילום, לכבידת שני יהודי ראש. נזהר את פרסום גלוריפיקיישן. כיוון שאומר קבדת, זיכו וסימחו, חוזרו לדברי פרשני. רוב אומר מיוחד, ראש דבורך אלף, ראש דבורך ולסייף דבורך, אלא מסייף דבורך ניקה שראש דבורך אלף. Is it expressed succinctly and non-agreeable? Because if you want to know how indispensable faith is, you just pay attention to the last few divrei, whether they are observed and implemented by society or not, and complied with by society or not. The gist of that minor is identical with that of the previous saying by Rabbi Hananya ben Chachinoy, that social iniquity and immorality are precipitated by the denial of divine authority. In other words, the vehicle of social ethics is faith in a transcendental personal God who expects man to follow in his footsteps or to imitate him. At the beginning, the Malcher of the skeptics says the Nefeviliyye are socially irrelevant, since it's possible to organize a society on the foundation of a man-made morality. However, they have realized finally, later, that without an Nefevi, man forfeits his ethical sensitivity and becomes oblivious of the most elementary principles of morality. Yes, it's correct. Does history confirm that viewpoint? What does history confirm? It is our viewpoint, not our life. I don't believe I told you anything new. I believe the best illustration, the best proof is Russia. And I want you to understand, when people speak about bankruptcy of religion and about the failure and the palm, clergymen, men of God, and there's a lot of truth to the accusation, but as a whole, the accusation is false. And the best proof that such an accusation is false, and mean, and undeserving, is Russia. I do not assert that the West has achieved great moral lives. Far from it. Western society is far from being perfect, a perfect moral community. It is hypocritical, great extent, sanctimonious, secret, and self-righteous. And quite often, as we have experienced, indifferent to the woes and suffering of a downtrodden and weak people. We have experienced it before. However, the West is still somewhat sensitive to moral issues. You can argue with the government of Britain. You know, whether the argument is good or not, I don't know. But at least you have the opportunity to argue. You may argue, you may debate with our State Department officials. Whether it's helpful or it's a waste of time, I don't know. Those people go to Washington. They should decide. I don't know. Never mind. You may even engage Pompidou in an argument. Even Mrs. Pompidou. Because she's responsible for the commotion. She's a kind of a mania. A chayil ha-chayish. And she was in Chicago. And she thought of my benefit. And she was in Chicago. The demonstration to play Russian, the demonstration was justified violence, but it was a different problem. Whether it was white political, it was a different problem. The demonstration took place, and she says, police. The police had cleared the path, and she says, it's clear through them. So she said, she began to complain, they touched me. So I reminded myself, and I moved into the cave to answer, that the next door neighbor of mine was an old Irishman, but not he was descended from old Irish stock who came to America before the revolution. He was an Irish aristocrat. He used to say this family came long before the Kennedy family. And he was a gentleman, a perfect gentleman, aristocrat. And still he looks typically Irish. Blue eyes, fat nose, and smile in his eyes. And he used to tell me the little boy, human, an old man, intelligent. And the little boy, his mother used to take him to John Marsh, south of my mother. Well, so many years ago, 16 or 17 years ago, only he cried himself and became human. Come well to speak of him, I think, good man. So he used to come, and some of the ladies came in circles, he used to tell them. Sometimes he used to brush again then, because he used to take a move, look at me, identifying him as an Irish boy. Exactly what Mr. Spencer just said about the Jews. In fact, well, but still you can argue with them. Do it, tries at least to justify his actions or its inaction, to explain, to at least somehow to fool us, to deceive us. It feels good many a time, and I'm ready to believe, embarrassed. And from time to time, the West is ready, even though always, even though feebly, to correct mistakes. What about Russia? About Brezhnev, Khrushchev, Figin, Sergonis? Can one reproach her? Can you debate any issue with them? Any rebuke will be scornfully rejected. It engages in no debate. It distorts facts, falsifies historical data. Accusing, for instance, I mean, beautiful. Accusing legal Israel of imperialism and colonialism, while she herself is the most brutal colonial imperialistic power, I would say, in human history. The Jews committed an international crime when they invaded Egypt in order to protect the lives of the issue and prevent Nasser from massacring 2 million Jews. That Nasser, who won the war, would be another Treblinka and Auschwitz in Schloss Buchenwald, and a few more camps, extermination camps in Auschwitz. And Russia, of course, acted in accordance with international morality, was motivated by the purest considerations, and then she occupied Czechoslovakia. Russia is immoral, it's very bone marrow, cruel and brutal, completely insensitive to morality. Why? This is a strange question. Marxism? People make no sense. Marxism is fundamentally an ethical doctrine. But far more ethical than an economic doctrine. The underlying idea of Marxist economics and econometrics is justice, fairness. Labor, according to Marx, creates the economic value system, hence the so-called Überwert, belongs to the laborer, not to the investor or capitalist. And the fascination of Marxism for young people, for African tribes, lies not in the economics, in the economic theory, but in the ethical machine. Don't forget that Marxism, at the turn of the century, was a gospel, was a religion. People sacrifice their lives. And yet, this ethical doctrine turns into a gospel of brutality and tyranny. You want to know the answer? I have only one. The answer was provided by Chazal. Moal o mal badeshen ve kichesh ben. All 10 commandments were uttered in one sentence. They are indivisible and indestructible as a whole. Yes. However, the invisibility of the Ten Commandments conveys to us another idea. Chazal, in stating that the Ten Commandments were spoken, formulated in one action, wanted stressing the indivisibility of the Decalogue, wanted also to convey another idea. It's indivisible just in the opposite direction, in reverse. Very important for Orthodox Jews to know, and modern Jews in particular. While one must neither separate the social norm from the theological faith premise, there is Hirtoch, and there is Signet, and there is Sinoch, and there is Hanech, from an Eichi Ad Hashem Rekecho, nor should one try to accept the premise without embracing the rest of the divine. What the Haggadah has proclaimed by integrating the principle of faith into the system of the moral law has revolutionary character. First of all, there are no secular habits. Don't forget, Greeks, Romans didn't know that. To them, ethics was secular. Because the very term of ethics, ethos, means social convention, social concern, social agreement, habits, common habits, common customs, certainly not a revealed law, not a law. Hermann Cohen tries to show that Plato was different. Plato understood that the moral law is absolute and ultimate. It's not for men to break it. And if Plato did understand it, by a good explanation, that Plato, though it's quite possible that Plato visited Egypt, met in Egypt either Bold on a Rio or Red Rapids. Of course, you know, German anti-Semites said that the ninth letter in Plato is not authentic, it's apocryphal. But he writes that he met with the wise men of the Orient, and he learned from them whatever was possible to learn, to understand. Of course, it means that he met with Jews that the German historians could not tolerate. But he says, the letter is apocryphal. But the letter is not apocryphal. So it means if he actually came out with ideas, and he glossed, and in matter of fact, the idea did not emerge, in his first work, but in his later work, and the Lord. And so he certainly was influenced by Jews. I mean, don't forget that at the end of the decline of the first Commonwealth, the Jewish emigration from Arabia was to Egypt. That's powerful. Very strong, and many Jews faculty in Egypt. I mean, you know the story about the Rio and Bar-Rio. But anyway, this was what number one that the Jews proclaimed the world. Have the ethos is decreed by God. Man cannot make his own law. Secondly, the Jews proclaimed another principle. Namely, the principle of existential unity. The latter, existential unity, is a condition sine qua non for the attainment of a perfect life. Go. And since every attribute turns into a moral norm, men must try hard to achieve at least relative ontological unity. He was created in the image of God. God is one in the most ultimate, the most absolute sense. Man cannot be one in the most ultimate, the absolute sense, because he has an inner contradiction within himself. He has an inner schism within himself. But rest assured, to achieve some form of unity. The schism in men's lives is something intolerable. And Jehovah has insisted, and this is very important for us to know, that life be not divided into two sections, the mundane and the sacred, or the street and the synagogue, or the office, and the house of worship. Unity is inherent in the very fabric of human existence. The latter, the existence, can be either completely mundane or completely sacred. He is confronted with his maker not only in the house of worship, where he is ready for the meeting, but also in places he does not expect God to be found. And Avodas Hashem is associated with the entire human existence, with his complete, colorful spectrum, with a complete, colorful spectrum of one's life. God is worshipped not only through the offering of sacrifices, through prayer, prostration, but also and perhaps mainly through practicing social morality, through displaying kindness toward one's fellow man, through extending help to the needy, and treating one's subordinates differently. The example, personification of that, so please don't accuse me of trying to promote my own member of my own family, who was my grandfather of her. He actually once at Mayor Berlin called me, he asked three people, three rabbis out in the family, what the task of a rabbi consists of. He asked Rabbi Chashulchan, and his grandfather. He asked Rabbi Foyle Balozhner, who had come. Rabbi Chashulchan sent for the task of a rabbi to pass the mission. This is called Rabbi Chashulchan. Rabbi Chaim said, the task of a rabbi, China, finally, the track of silence to look at that. You can do it any other time. And my job is to help the needy, to protect the persecuted, to defend the widow if someone, some powerful person is persecuting her, or is inflicting some horror, to feed the orphan, because of kind. The Chaim Chesed was absolutely fantastic. As a matter of fact, you know, Reb Chaim left in Savoy. There's no title being inscribed on the tomb now. And the children complying in Savoy, with one exception, Reb Chesed. With Chaim Goyen, Rashi Behar, that's all the revolutionaries, the terror world, Reb Chesed. And if you ask me what Reb Chaim Ha'evi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, certainly, to what will happen. Stories about the way, you know, the children, the illegitimate children are adopted, because they brought them up, and the head of the school, I mean, the story about the revolutionary, you know, and the Kippah, and saved his wife, Reb Chaim, and so forth, I mean,